Here's to another episode of the Process Podcast. We are doing Sensation Spectacular, episode number 5, and today we have Owen Wiseman of Image Comics' Samurai Blood. Samurai Blood is his first published comic work, but Owen is also a screenwriter for Benaroya Pictures. They are a film production studio, but they also happen to have a comic publishing branch behind two other Image titles that you may have heard of, Marksman and Red Spike, and we are very lucky to have Owen to speak about his work and about his writing process. Owen, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Curtis. I really appreciate it.
No problem. How's the day going for you today? It's a Friday. Friday afternoon for the both of us.
It is a Friday afternoon, and it's I'm here in LA, and it's raining for the first time in several weeks, which I love it when it rains here because I'm from the Northwest, so it reminds me of home.
Well, where are you from originally?
From Seattle.
Seattle. Oh, I love that town.
It's a great town, especially in the summer.
Well, I've been there for the Seattle or Emerald City Comic Con a few years in a row now, and that is definitely my favorite con.
Really? Oh, that's good to hear. I had a fantastic time at Fan Expo in Toronto this year. I know you're from Canada. I thought that was probably my favorite con of the year. I mean, they're all fun, and it's all kind of new to me still, but Fan Expo was just awesome. The crowd up there was so great.
You know, actually, you were sitting at the Image table, and I never got a chance to come over and talk to you. I don't know, like maybe it was where I was sitting. I just had no traffic, and I found it was really difficult because I was in a corner where people kept on like walking, you know, in behind me to get to their tables, and I was really frustrated. I found that the Fan Expo was just really, really quiet for me.
Huh? Yeah, it's amazing how much difference like 20 feet can make. Like we just kind of got the luck of the draw to get right on that main aisle there, and then I felt like at New York Comic Con recently, I felt a little bit like you felt because we were off kind of to the side and there was less traffic. So maybe it is just where you get put. But I had a great time at Fan Expo.
Well, you know, for me, it was Toronto was great because I was there with my girlfriend and her sister came by and met us. So it was actually more the experiences outside the con that were really fun for me. And I'd never been to Toronto before either. So this year has been of a lot of experiences for conventions. It's been an excuse for me to travel, which has been awesome.
Yeah, it's always great when you can write off that travel expense. I'll go pretty much anywhere under those circumstances.
Yeah, exactly. But have you been to Emerald City Comic Con yet?
I have not been to Emerald City. I think we're going to go this year is going to be our first year. We're going to go with the books. So I'm definitely looking forward to it because that's one that a lot of my family and friends will be able to get out to. And that should be a great time, I hope.
Oh, yeah. And the Seattle one's great. At least the times that I've been there in the last few years, it's much more comic focused. There are celebrities and stuff there, but the stars of the show are the comic creators and people trying to like, you know, pitch their projects and I love it. So, yeah, I think you guys will have a great time.
I'm really looking forward to it.
So let's get into your writing history. Where did this interest in writing begin for you?
Well, it's funny. You know, I kind of – growing up, I knew where I was going. I just didn't know that I was going there sort of thing. Like my stepmom was a copywriter and my dad has written some, but I never really realized, oh, you could actually do that like for a living. You could get paid to tell stories. I would grew up acting. I also did sports, but I was in theater and I did a bunch of plays. And then what I really started doing where I sort of really discovered that I love storytelling was I was the dungeon master for a bunch of role-playing games with my friends.
Nice.
We played everything from, I mean, we played like GURPS back in the day. I used to play with a bunch of my friends. And then we got into like when we got a little older, my friends got a little bit emo and we started playing like Vampire the Masquerade and all these different games. And I realized one day that I was spending way more time on coming up with these worlds to play, you know, at my friend Shannon's basement on Friday night and Saturday nights than I was like doing homework or doing anything like that. Like it was, you know, I did homework well enough to get good grades, but I would go overboard on these worlds and these stories. And looking back, that's where I was discovering how much I love to do it. And I did, at the time, I never thought, oh, this means I want to be a writer. I just knew that I was filling notebooks with, you know, character sketches and like all kinds of crazy stuff like that. But yeah, looking back, that creating those worlds and doing that stuff was a huge way to get started for me. And then I went to college down here at Pomona, just outside of LA. And I was a philosophy major and did a lot of like analytical writing, and then I never really got that into sort of fiction or storytelling. I was just – and throughout this whole time as well, I was reading all the time. I mean, all I did when I was a kid was read, just read under my desk, read every night, all the time. So I was lost in books. But then senior year of college, I took a creative writing class and discovered that – well, I thought I was great at it at the time. It turned out I sucked at that point. But what I did have then was I had – different things to say than a lot of other people had. Like, I was writing stories. A lot of people in that class were writing very personal stories about their family. Basically, they were sort of trying to write like Jonathan Franzen, you know, sort of capture the spirit of how hard it is to be whatever they were.
Right.
And I was writing about, you know, I wrote a story about two cowboys standing on a hill watching sheep being slaughtered. And I wrote about, you know, I was writing just, I had different ideas and different interests than most of the other people had. And that was what kind of when I went, oh, maybe I could do this. Maybe I have enough things that other people aren't really into that I could make interesting, that I could actually sort of make a career out of it, which I think is what a lot of people – and well, I'm sure we'll get more into this as we go on. But to me, that's what a lot of people who want to write for a living don't understand about it, is that it's not just about getting good at writing. It's about developing something to say. Like, it's about having things that you know about and are passionate about that other people maybe haven't considered before, so that you can then exploit those things as stories.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the topics that we've talked about on the show a little bit is write something that you want to read, and that, you know, especially if it's something that you know about or you find interesting, there are going to be other people out there that find it just as inspiring or just as interesting or may want to learn about it. And, you know, that's where stories start to resonate with people.
And even if they don't, you know, even if it's not maybe the thing that they would be the most interested in, they'll connect with your passion about it. Like, I'm reading a book right now called, oh, I forget the author's name, but it's called Rats. And it's a history of rats in New York. Now, I'm not in love with rats. I don't think they're the most interesting thing in the world. But this guy does, who's writing, he thinks they're fascinating. And that's fascinating enough for me to read the book, just to sort of observe his passion for this subject. And hopefully, certainly with Samurai's Blood, I think anybody who's into samurai or ninja, that kind of stuff, is going to be into the book. But even if you're not into that, if you just like reading things by people who are really passionate about the things that they're writing about, then people like that are going to like this book too. And that's the kind of person I am. I'll read anything as long as the person is really passionate about it and has put a lot of work into it and cares about it.
So the you know, Samurai's Blood is your first comic work. Is that kind of your prime passion, like the history, the Japanese history? Is that kind of your main love?
Well, no, I would describe that as one intellectual interest among many. I mean, I'm a big history buff. I love anything to do with history, and historical fiction's a genre that I'll always work in and write in. You know, there's a lot of great ways to attack that. I mean, from the fiction side, for example, there's a book called Doomsday Book by Connie Willis that's an amazing book about future scientists who travel back in time. So it's a sci-fi concept, but she also gets to write historical fiction. I love stuff like that, combining different elements. So it's not that samurai ninja are something I'm very passionate about, but it's one thing among many, and I want to write all different kinds of things. As far as the sort of choice between different media, I'm equally passionate, I would say, about comic books, movies, and prose. You know, writing novels, short stories, novellas, that kind of thing. And I think that I'm equally passionate about them because each of those three things can do things that the other two can't. Comic books, actually, in particular, in some ways, are an interesting combination of prose's ability to take in really big ideas, but also having pictures, which
right.
makes it much more engaging. So, you know, I'm very passionate about working in all three of those domains.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I also have a novel coming out this month, and you know, I wrote it quite a long while ago, and I'd sworn after writing it that I would never write another novel or prose again because it's such a time commitment. But after I kind of, you know, I started seeing the press releases, and I'm like, oh, you know, like I started thinking about writing prose again, and it's totally different. Like writing novels and writing comics is two different things. And writing novels is something that you do on your own, and you're very much in your own world. There's comics, you're always working with a team of people. So I think it's a nice balance, actually, to switch back and forth between the two.
And I once heard Neil Gaiman say a smart thing about it, which echoed what you just said, where he basically said, look, I go and write a novel and I'm way wrapped up in my own head. Of course, he said this in a you know, clever and awesome Neil Gaiman way, but he said basically, you know, I go and I write a novel and I'm all wrapped up in my own head and I'm alone all the time and I get kind of lonely. It's nice to then go onto a set and like write an episode of Doctor Who and sort of present it to people and have this time with other people. And then when that's done, I usually want to go back and be alone for a while. And I feel exactly the same way. Like, one of the things I love about being a writer and yet working in Hollywood is that, or for example, being a writer and working with Nam Kim on Samurai's Blood, is that you get to do both. I feel a strong need to have both of those things, which is, maybe there are other jobs like this, but I think writing, you get these extremes a lot where it's like I go to a convention and I'm talking to people nonstop for 4 days. Yeah. And it's great. But then by the end of the 4 days, I'm like, oh, man, I am so ready to go sit in a room and get a mug of hot cocoa and just like be behind my computer by myself for 8 hours or so. You know, so it, having both those things, it can get a little bit schizophrenic, but that's what I love about the job, that and not getting up early.
So your experiences at the cons, and I mean, this is probably as far as comic conventions, relatively new for you. Do you find that you transition quite easily into kind of the sales role when it comes to talking to people to sell your book?
Well, I would say I don't think it's easy to necessarily make that transition. I'm lucky enough that, you know, I think partially it's because I have a performance background. I did grow up acting and a lot of that stuff. I'm very comfortable talking to people, so I don't have that problem. Where I think just from observing a lot of the people at these conventions, a lot of these creators, they don't really enjoy talking to people that much.
Right.
And I really do enjoy talking to people. So, you know, Jeff Kahn and Dave Baxter, who write Red Spike and Marksman respectively, are both the same way. They all enjoy talking to people together. So our table is quite lively. But, you know, after the first 4 hours of the first day, those conventions are trade shows. You know, it's work. Like, there's no doubt about it. But it's the best, worst part of a job ever, you know, like it's kind of the only thing I really do that's really a grind is going to those shows. But man, what a great grind. Like what a first world problem, you know.
Yeah, totally. I could totally agree with you on that one. I definitely enjoy the con experience, but you're right, that last day you're feeling exhausted, and it's you're constantly pitching your stuff. And how many times have you said the exact same thing over and over and over again? And
that's just it's not even like I'm tired, but more than anything, I'm a little punchy by the last day. I'm just like, is this real life? Like, you do end up pitching the same thing over and over. But you know, there's also, I think, from my perspective, because I spend time, you know, pitching people on movies and trying to get that stuff going, you know, there's value in that, in learning how to do that and learning how to take a pitch and make it seem alive for you and make it seem – I mean, it's almost – I've never done stand-up comedy, but it's a little bit like I would imagine stand-up comedy to be, where like you have to – part of the skill is you have to learn how to sort of put yourself into saying it or into doing it, into being present and being there. In order to sell effectively. And for a writer, that's a very useful skill to have. Like, whether you're going into pitch series to people, you know, you're going into whatever, Marvel, and you got a meeting and you're trying to pitch to them, or you're whoever you're trying to pitch to, you really just get that one shot. So you better be able to summon that energy and fill the pitch with it when you get that shot.
Right, you gotta have that level of excitement yourself that you want them to have, or else, you know, it's just never gonna come across the way you want it to.
Exactly, and that's, I think, in terms of, I'm always thinking, when we're having this conversation, I'm thinking about other people who want to be creators and who want to get their own stuff going, listening to it. I think it's important to understand that's a skill. Like, knowing how to do that, how to make those pitches come alive and how to make that work, is very much a skill. It's very much something you can learn to do, and it's something you have to learn to do. There are very few born salespeople on the planet. I'm sure there are some, but there's not that many. Most people who are good at it practiced it, thought about how they were going to do it, and then went out and tried to start executing that.
Yeah, like I know my first, especially my first few like interviews that I did, that was, you know, just earlier this year in Seattle, actually. I remember they, I looked back and MTV Geek was doing a bunch of interviews, and they kind of tapped me on the shoulder and said I was next. And I had no idea that I was going to be interviewed. And that was like my first real experience. And I mean, I think I did okay, but like from then, you know, I watched that video and I'm like, geez, I have a lot to learn about, you know, being confident and, you know, just constantly looking at my other interviews and trying to, you know, cut out the extra words like ums and ahs and you knows and just trying to be much more professional and being really confident. And that's something that I'm always working on, because, you know, if you're not confident about your own stuff, everyone's going to know it.
Yeah, well, and it's the same. I mean, it's the same sort of energy it takes to pick up a girl or whatever, like whatever you're trying to do in life. You know, you got to sort of bring it. And it's no different trying to sell stories to people at conventions or to, you know, executives. And I think that skill of sort of being able to summon that energy also carries over into writing, I would argue. I think sitting at your computer sometimes, you're not always going to feel 100% on. Like, you sometimes have to be able to write or have to be able to produce when you're not having like your best, most creative, most amazing day. And so being able to sort of have that as a skill rather than as some mysterious muse is an important thing to do, I think.
Oh yeah, totally. That's a lesson I'm always learning too. I recently quit my day job so that I could
write full time. I saw that. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a huge step for me. But you know, there's an element of fear in that, because, you know, there are days when I sit here and I'm like, you know, I'm working for this company and my schedule is kind of my own. There's not a lot of deadlines, but you know, my own deadlines are what matter. Like, you know, I'm responsible for my own work. And man, like, there are days when you just sit there and you're looking at the screen and like, there's just nothing there. But at the end of the day, I'm accountable to myself and you have to get it done. So you're right. You just have to just really remind yourself, you know, I can do this. I have the skill and I've gotten this far, you know, on my ability to work hard and on my talent that I should be able to produce. And yeah, I totally agree with you. You have to be able to bring that mindset just daily with you, carry it around with you.
And yeah, and not be, and I think the first lesson is to not be too precious. You know, understand that when I'm sitting down to write a screenplay, what I try to tell myself is I can type a screenplay in about 2 hours, but it's going to take 4 months to write one. You know, right. It's going to take 4 to 6 months. So a lot of that time is going to be spent doing things that don't end up in the final product. You know, so it's okay to have those times, but you have to keep moving forward. You have to keep trying to do the next step, and you fail and you fail and you fail and you fail. And then eventually you get it. And part of, I think, being a professional is having the confidence and also just having done it before, having a track record of having gotten through the process. I now don't have any doubt when I sit down, okay, I'm going to be able to finish this screenplay or this comic script or whatever, because I've done it dozens of times before.
Right. Yeah, totally agree with you.
And for me, I was just going to pick up on what you were saying. I don't want to leave you quitting your day job quite yet, because I wanted to talk to you about this. I think it's a great
sure.
I remember I was here in LA, and I had been basically delivering groceries and working crappy PA gigs and waiting tables when I could find a place to do it for more than 3 years. And I had finally sort of worked myself around. I had a pretty good restaurant job that I didn't have to work too hard at and that paid a decent wage. And then my friend came and, you know, wanted to start a film company and wanted me to come work for him. And I didn't have that much hesitation about it, because he was offering an ongoing position, whereas you said yours was 3 months, right? And then you're going to be on your own.
Yeah.
So this was a full-time thing, but still, it's a fledgling film company. Who knows? You know, like, I'm working for a restaurant where I'm going to know how much money I'm going to make and it's going to be around and yada, yada. And I ended up taking a little bit of a pay cut and going and working with him instead. And now 5 years later, here we are. But for me, at least, that being able to quit my day job was such bliss that it provided an insane amount of motivation, you know? And now, and I still feel that 5 years later, like whenever I'm tempted to slack off, I still just think, oh, you could be back at Michael J's waiting tables. You know, right. you could be doing this, you could be doing that. You better get sit down and get it done because there's 1,000 people who would be happy to take your place.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's definitely one of the things that, you know, I think people like us who have this kind of creative bone in our body, I think really the ultimate destination for us, if we really push through what we want to do, the eventuality is that we are going to quit our jobs and write full time. And, you know, sometimes people do it without maybe the float in place that allows them to do it. And it's a bit, you know, bit of a crazy endeavor. But, you know, I look at my past and the amount of jobs, like you said, you were working in these terrible jobs all along. I think so many people like us do that. They work these really terrible jobs because they know what they really want to do, but they just are afraid to actually try to do it. And so they end up working these, you know, they work at a job for a year or two and then they switch jobs and they switch jobs. That was totally my MO for the longest time until I landed something that was fairly good. Kind of like you said, you know, you had a job that it paid well and it was fairly easy. I did the same thing. I was driving city bus for almost 3 years and it was a fairly easy gig. And allowed me a lot of time to think about my projects and think about my writing. But at the end of the day, when I was, you know, putting in 80-hour weeks, I just had to make a choice, and this was the opportunity to do it. So,
yeah, and I mean, and I think what I would like to say to, you know, to people out there who are in that position is not that you should be in a super hurry to quit your day job. You should wait until you have the right opportunity, you know, until you can actually make something work financially where you go, okay, I'm going to have a little bit of breathing room and it's going to be okay for a while. Because nothing will take you out of the game faster than really going broke to the point where you can't even pay your rent. You know, then you're really in trouble and then you're not going to be thinking about writing at all. And also I think, cause I remember doing those 80, 90, 100 hour even weeks where, you know, I would work all day and then come home and go into my room and put in 4 or 5 hours in my room at night when I was dead tired. As miserable as that was, learning to write that way makes it seem a lot easier once you don't have a job. You know, like it's like, oh,
right.
Man, I get up in the morning and all I have to do is this. Like, this is awesome. You know, you really build up skills by doing it that way. You build up determination, you find out how bad you really want it, you know, all those kinds of things, and it builds a lot of confidence. So the stage of having a crappy day job and working at night and scrapping to find as many hours as you can to possibly do it, I think that's a valuable stage too. And I'm not saying that people should, you know, rush through that because frankly, and if you guys have talked about this in the podcast before, and I completely agree with it, back when I was doing that, I wasn't ready to be a professional. Like I wasn't good enough. You know, my stuff was not consistently good enough and I'm talking about for years, this is true. When I was writing in college, I moved to Portland after college and continued writing for, you know, this is 4, 5, 6 years into writing every single day, and my stuff still wasn't good enough yet. So it would have been a mistake to quit all my jobs and just say, well, the next thing has to be the thing that works or I'm going to be out on the street. Like that would have been a big mistake. So know who you are, be honest about your evaluation. And then, man, when you get a chance to quit your day job and do it full time, work as hard as you possibly can to stay there because it's awesome.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I think that's really solid advice. The only thing that I could add to that is find a really rich partner and just live off of them while you write. So that's another way you can also go.
Oh man, I'm looking for a sugar mama so hard. I know anybody. No, I'm just kidding. I've actually got a fantastic girlfriend who is the light of my life and who's awesome. So I don't want that to be out there.
Oh, fair enough. But you know, we can talk after. If you want me to cut that, we can. Maybe I'll work something out.
She knows I'm not going anywhere.
Well, let's get a bit to, I guess, let's talk a bit about the comic you have out right now, Samurai's Blood. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about what the story is and the characters and.
Sure. Well, kind of the overall concept of the comic is to do a more sort of realistic and more grounded samurai story. So, I've loved a lot of samurai comics that have come out, particularly I really loved The Path, Ron Mars's book. I just thought it was really cool and well done. But what a lot of samurai books have done is they always seem to introduce some other element. So it's like samurai, you know, the path is samurai, but there's also supernatural powers in it. There's sort of supernatural things happening. And in other ones, you know, they'll take samurai and they'll put them in the future. Or they'll put them in a different world, whatever.
Right.
And I noticed, like you say, write something you want to read. You said that to me earlier.
Yeah.
And I decided that I thought that there was room and I really wanted to read a more like grounded samurai epic that reminded me of the films that I grew up loving, like Kurosawa movies, and more recently, some films by Yoji Yamada that have won some Japanese Academy Awards in the last 10 years, Twilight Samurai and The Hidden Blade, are these amazing movies that are really grounded and really terse and really sort of real and direct. So that's kind of the overall idea of the book, is to show samurai ninjas they might really have been, to make the fighting more realistic, to make all that kind of stuff a little more real. The story is a classic revenge tale. It concerns three teenaged samurai from the same mountain village, and they're part of the ruling clan of their province. And when the whole rest of their clan is destroyed, these three have to go on the run, and their village is burned to the ground, their parents are killed, everybody. This is in the first issue. They have to go on the run, sort of figure out who did it, learn how to survive, and then eventually take their vengeance. That's sort of the overall arc of the story. But it also concerns how they relate to the samurai code and how they understand it and the real-life problems that confront them trying to live according to the samurai code, but also trying to get things done, you know, also trying to take vengeance and formulate a plan and all that stuff. And it ends up eventually starting to tear them apart, and they have to make some really difficult choices in that arena. So that's kind of the overall idea of the series. And it's not – I want to stress, like, it's set in feudal Japan and it's about samurai and ninja. But I think people who just like cool comics that are dense and are well-paced and certainly well-drawn will also dig this. You know, it's an accessible human story is the idea.
Yeah, one of the things that I enjoyed about it was the fact that, you know, after they lose everything and they're on the run, you know, they basically want to seek revenge. But, you know, one of them points out, look, we can't just go right after him. We have to actually, like, you know, he's well protected. He's, you know, he's unreachable for us right now. We have to pay our dues. And I think that's very interesting because, you know, as younger characters, they're going to have, you know, this whole head full of ideas that, you know, very teenage thing that, you know, they're invincible and that, you know, it's just going to be an easy thing of walking up to the guy and stabbing him. But that's not the reality. They actually have to pay their dues. They have to earn the money to earn favor and get some people on their side to accomplish their mission, which I think is actually kind of realistic.
Yeah, and I mean, and also certainly I would say that's the emotional core of it is it's kind of – it's not it's a coming-of-age story in a certain way. It's about these three kids discovering that the world is a lot more complicated of a place than they thought it was. And in that sense, it certainly tracks, I would say, you know, my own life over the last 10 years, like going from being basically still in high school to being out in the world and finding out, oh, man, like it's not all just super easy. Like everything's not going to be uncomplicated. And then eventually getting to where I am now and sort of putting it back together and figuring out, you know, how to make my way in the world. It certainly tracks that emotional journey. And that's what I say when I mean when I say it's a human story is I think everybody goes through that sometime in their teens or 20s, hopefully not their 30s, but sometime in their teens or 20s, pretty much everybody goes through that of thinking that something is going to be really simple and then realizing, oh man, there's all these things that I didn't even know were here that are going to get in the way.
Yeah, exactly. I definitely was like that myself. You know, I had a lot of lofty ideas that, you know, I mean, I've spoken previously about I was in a relationship and I was with a woman who was from Australia, and we had this idea that, oh, you know, we'll live in Canada for a year, we'll work, and then we'll travel to Australia and we'll live there for a year, and we'll just come back and forth. And it's like, that's just not reality. That's just not how it works.
There's expensive. There's all these problems.
Yeah, you know, it's just like once that reality sets in, you know, you have to go through that disappointment in order to gain any kind of perspective on, you know, on your life. So, yeah, totally. I can totally identify with those characters are going through.
The good thing about that, though, is if you didn't, you know, if we didn't go through that kind of stuff, we wouldn't have anything to write about. You know, like, it's that kind of stuff that makes things accessible and human. And that's why you don't, I think that's one big reason why you don't see that many 20 or 22 year old writers that are amazing. There's just not that many. It just doesn't happen that much. Whereas there are a lot of 20 or 22 year olds that are sort of geniuses in the sciences or mathematical geniuses, that kind of stuff. But writing is so much about living. It's so much about experience and sort of knowing how things are that at 20 or 22, you could probably write a great book about what it's like to be a teenager, but you can't really write a great book about what it's like to be an adult because you're not one. You don't have that experience, you know, in the same way that it would be tough. It's sometimes difficult for me to write about what it's like to be a parent in a really deep way because I'm not one. You know, I don't know really what that's like yet. So I end up thinking about my younger brothers and sisters and looking at their relationship with my parents. And that's good. I can sort of get there enough to have the veneer of verisimilitude, I guess. But I don't have that core experience. And I think I do have experiences emotionally like the ones in Samurai's Blood. And I think that's one really important piece of my process, at least, is I don't have to have lived in 17th century Japan in order to write about it necessarily, but I do have to have lived these emotions. I do have to have Right. felt the things that these characters are feeling in order for it to really resonate with me and thus with the reader.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it becomes pretty obvious if you're writing outside pretty extensively what you know, if you're just basing it on, you know, things that you've read, or, you know, if you don't have something to tie in that historical research or something to tie in, you know, whatever your story is about emotionally, then the story may be interesting in, you know, one sense that, you know, that's very informational, but the draw isn't going to be there to draw people into the story.
Yeah, I mean, then it's a textbook. You know, it's an encyclopedia. You know, you have to get in there and live it. You have to get in there and figure out what's going on at the core of these characters and how can I relate that to something in my own life. And I'd say that's when people say write what you know, I always take it to mean that more than like I don't have to write about what it's like to be a writer in his 20s. Like I don't have to write about that, but I do have to write about emotions that I understand.
Exactly. So with Samurai's Blood, how did everything come together? Was this a script you wrote a long time ago and you just, you know, it was always a comic, you couldn't find an artist? Or is this something that's just come up recently? What was the origin of the series?
Well, no, the origin of the series was Mike Benaroya, who is the founder and CEO of Benaroya Pictures and Benaroya Publishing. He came to me with the bare bones outline of this story, basically about a revenge tale about three kids who are in this village and yada, yada. And he said that, and I had been thinking about Samurai and Ninja since literally middle school. I'd been studying them. And when he said that, it just bloomed in my mind like a flower, and I realized, oh, this is going to work for something. Like, we're going to be able to make something out of this. And so then we started developing it along a lot of different lines. And then when he decided to do a comics imprint, when he started Benaroya Publishing, this was just a natural fit. It was one of those things where this is a comic. This is going to work as a comic in a way that it would be really difficult to make it as a movie. You know, it's one of those things, not only because it's hard to get money for a movie, but because if you look at the comic, I think there are a lot of direct ideas that I've put in the comic in terms of that's what's so great about comics is you can write on the page. You can put text on the page and it's not considered out of bounds, whereas voiceover in film has to be used very sparingly or it's going to become obtrusive and take away from the story. So right. I think this works in a way, it works uniquely as a comic. Now, that's not to say I would be opposed to trying to make a movie at some point, but I think anyone who reads it will see I felt very strongly about this as a comic, and I think the comics medium has unique features that work really well for this story. So I was excited to get to do it in that sense. And so because I work with, in terms of physically how the comic came together, because I work with Ben Arroyo, he was going to do several series sort of contracted with Image. So I didn't have to pitch directly to them. I was able to sort of ride in on his coattails. And then Dave Elliott, who is the editor-in-chief of Ben Arroyo Publishing, sent me a number of different portfolios of artists, and I was able to – and I looked through them, saw Nam Kim's art, and was immediately like, oh, this is the guy. This has to be the guy. There's nobody else who could do this. Luckily, he hadn't blown up yet, although I seriously think Nam Kim is going to be a star. Like, he is an incredibly versatile, incredibly talented, incredibly professional artist. But we were lucky enough to get him on this, and it just went from there. Like, it went pretty fast once we got all those pieces in place. Once me and Nam started working together, I had done several comics projects before that hadn't gone anywhere. I'd written three or four scripts for various things that were not good and did not display – that were interesting enough stories – but I displayed my lack of having ever really thought about what comic structure was like. And there's a big difference between reading comics and thinking about how those comics are made. There's a big difference between that. Like, and so I had read stuff. I mean, I wasn't a huge comics guy growing up, but I had certainly read a number of comics and had realized I had never really thought about how they were made or what that was. And then anyways, a lot of the comics I'd read, like, you know, Frank Miller comics, you don't want to write comics like that necessarily, you know, like
right.
16 panels on a page and talking heads and this and that. Like, it works great for Frank Miller, but if I turned in a script like that to an artist, he would quit. So I sort of went back and one of my big influences for Samurai's Blood and putting it together was Neil Gaiman's Sandman series.
Okay.
Just in terms of being able to that and also, and this sounds a little funny, but Calvin and Hobbes is a big thing for me because A, I was obsessed with it when I was a kid, and B, those two books showed me that you can put big ideas next to pictures and make it really interesting. That comics are uniquely qualified to do big ideas. And so I went back and I reread a bunch of Sandman. And I found some Neil Gaiman scripts for Sandman, like in the back of one of his trades or something, and that was kind of a revelation for me because I realized, you know, when I write a movie script, it's very formalized in terms of the structure of the script. You must write in certain ways, in a certain voice. You can't, for example, you can't write in the first person. I think the movie should be like this. You have to write in this very specific way, in a very specific
right.
structure, because that script has to get sent out to a bunch of different department heads who need completely different things from it, and they have to all be able to get that out of your one script. So it has to be standardized. But I realized when I read Neil Gaiman scripts that in comics – you can be totally conversational, especially if you know who the artist is going to be. If you're writing something to pitch or you're writing something to send to a bunch of different editors, okay, you got to be a little more standardized. But knowing Nam and having taken a look at some of his stuff, I could just do the whole thing as a conversation with Nam, you know, where I could just be like, oh, here's what I think. Here's what it should be kind of like. Take a look at this like little movie still that I'm going to put in here. Like, it should be kind of like this, but different in this way. You know, you can do all those things. And once I got to that place, I was kind of off like a bull with gas, you know, like it made it so much easier. And so what ended up happening, particularly with the early Samurai's Blood scripts, is my scripts were way longer than the finished comic. You know, I do for a 24-page comic, I do a 30 or 35-page script just sort of talking to Nam about it and trying to give him as much information as possible because especially with this one, with Samurai's Blood, I had a pretty specific vision for how I wanted it to look and what I wanted it to be like. And Nam, in certain places, took my ideas and blew them out of the water. And basically every suggestion he made, I was like, oh, yeah, of course. But at the time I was writing the scripts, at least, I had very specific ideas about how I wanted things to go. So that – and then I started doing those scripts, and then I knocked all of them out in like probably 6 months. And Nam delivered the issues on time, and it's just been a dream. Like, it's once we – it all came together and we started working, you know, I don't see how it could have gone much better.
So the – it's all done. Even the art is all done. Like the whole book is ready to go.
The whole book is done. The fifth issue is in stores and the sixth one comes out November 30th. November 30th is a big day for Samurai's Blood. Our sixth issue comes out. And also that's the day that the previews catalog comes out where you can pre-order the trade of Samurai's Blood, which will be out in, I think, February.
Nice.
So yeah, November 30th is our last issue, and that's a big day. But yeah, I've been done with the scripts for probably 3 or 4 months now. I finished the last script, and Noms had most of the art done for most of that time. We're just, you know, shepherding it through the various processes. Which actually, speaking of which, I guess I would just add this since I was talking about the physical production of it. I don't know how you do it. I'd actually be interested to hear how you do it too, but. What I do is I do the script, and then Nam does the pencils, and Matt Dalton does the inks as well at that stage. I get it back. I'll do another script for the colorist where I make color notes on all the panels, like if anything needs to be a specific way. Then when the colors come back, then I do a lettering script, at which point I'll usually edit scenes. So like I'll have the finished comic in front of me, and I'll have like what I had said the words were going to be, but then I'll make – significant changes at that stage and rewrite entire scenes based on the art.
Like when you mean rewrite scenes, you mean just rewriting the dialogue?
Just rewriting the dialogue, but matching the dialogue better to what's going on in the panels. And it ends up – I have literally in a couple cases in Samurai's Blood, I literally changed the meaning of a scene. Like I changed what was happening in the scene based – you know, you can only do that in a talking heads conversational scene, which is not too many of in Samurai's Blood. But I remember in one specific case in the second issue where there was a page of them sitting there talking and I completely changed what it was about because the dialogue didn't work with the art anymore. Like it didn't – the art was good, very cool, but the faces and how it was arranged were different than what I had envisioned. And so the scene had to change in order to accommodate that. But that to me was a real revelation in doing this. I never thought that I would do that. But it turns out that I've made at least small changes to almost every single page at that lettering stage before it goes off to the letterer.
Yeah, that's pretty different from my it sounds like you work with a little bit of a larger team. Like the teams I work with, generally the artists handle most of the artistic responsibilities. So on say for instance Greenwake, it's Riley. He does the pencils, the inks, and the colors. He makes all the artistic decisions. So I basically write my script and I send it to him and that's it. But the thing is with Riley is that for quite a long time, he just recently moved, but we lived in the same town. So we were able to meet, you know, once or twice a week, we'd get together for coffee. So we would talk about the script long before it was written.
Oh, okay.
So when the script came together, he would know, you know, in the script, and I would detail out the, you know, the paneling, and then the dialogue would be in there. He knew what I was going for because we talked about the tone and the theme, and so that just automatically transferred over to the page. Now, I don't know if that'll be the same in other projects that I'm doing. You know, I might have to take a different approach to it, but that's definitely been my experience so far with both Intrepid's and Greenwake, actually.
Well, and also with what Riley's doing, you know, because he's doing it all himself, he's got a more unified artistic vision. Like Matt Dalton, our inker, and Nam, the main series artist, they work together. So they work in the same studio. But then our colorist is at Imaginary Friends, which is in a different country. And then our inker is Josh Aitken, who lives in, I think, New York. So, yeah, it's kind of that's interesting. I don't know if I – because, like, it will be different because on the second one I'm doing, The Fires of Avalon, the artist Javier Aranda lives in a different country and doesn't – can read English quite well but doesn't speak fluent English. And so I'm sending the script – I just send the script off to him and then I just get it back. I still get to do the relettering at the end though. I think that's okay. That's interesting. I think I would – I mean, obviously, you're going to do what they're going to let you do, but I think I would fight to keep that step in there to be able to redo the script before they letter it. Like, I think Samurai's Blood is much better for my having been able to do that. I guess it's on me that I can't figure out what I want my dialogue to be before I see the actual art. But that's been a really important step for me is being able to reletter.
Well, I think one of the things that helps me, especially on Green Wake, is that I do actually have an editor who, once the book is like colored and it's all ready, and then we do have a letterer who does it. Riley does take care of that. A guy named Kelly Tyndall letters our book for us. And he letters the book, and then he sends it to Jay Dodge, who's the editor for Image Shadowline. Mm-hmm. And she does a pass on it, and then she makes her changes, and then those changes are made. And she does still consult me on those changes if I'm okay with them, but generally she knows what she's doing because it's her job. So I just listen to what she has to say. Those changes are made, and then the book is complete. So I do have a second pair of eyes that does make changes if they're necessary. And it happens, you know, there are like certain things, like maybe even like spelling mistakes or turns of phrases that don't quite work. She takes care of all that for me. So I guess there is that check and balance on that one for me. But with my other scripts, it's not something I've done. Maybe something I should consider for new projects, especially when I'm, you know, working with new artists.
Yeah, I mean, I think it can be, you end up futzing around some, you know, you end up sort of sitting there staring at it. But there are, for the few changes that I've made that have been really important, I think also, I did want to point out, to give credit where credit is most certainly due, that Dave Elliott, our editor in charge, he does, at every stage of this process, he looks and gives me notes and all that kind of stuff. So I don't want to make it seem like I'm doing it all myself at all. Like there's Samurai's Blood is good because a lot of people have worked to make it good. And I'm a beneficiary as much as I'm a cause of that.
Yeah, it's nice when you have and it's nice that you have such a large team working on it. You get a lot of different inputs and different styles put into the book, so you're really getting a real diverse feel in just one comic book.
Yeah, well, that's one of the cool things about doing working with Benaroya Publishing is that it's within Image, but we're doing our books together. So a lot of the same people are working on these books. Like Javier is the artist from who's doing Fires of Avalon for me. He's worked on some of our other books. Nam Kim, who did Samurai's Blood, is going to do Redeemer. So we're all kind of, which is Jeff Kahn's next book. So, you know, we're all sort of getting to help each other, in the process of trying to do this. Also, there was one other thing I wanted to tell you about in terms of selling books and promotions and that kind of stuff, because I think that's a really important – I mean, obviously, it's just a really important piece of the business. Is figuring out how to sell these books. We're doing a thing where some Image creators are getting together for this thing called Buy Me, which our editor Dave Elliott's putting together, where we're all going to help promote each other's books. And there's a PDF that you can embed on your website, and it's on a lot of people's websites already. It's on Bleeding Cool. It's on a bunch of different places. And it just has covers and samples of everyone's books, so that if somebody likes one of our books, they'll maybe go and pick up the others, or people can see that and have a preview that we can send around the web. And as new books from these creators get put up or get made, you know, they'll go on there and it'll be just kind of a rolling sort of thing to help promote and to help fans keep track of who's doing what at Image. So that's something I wanted to tell fans about too. Be on the lookout. It's just called Buy Me.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that we've talked a bit about on the show, and we've talked with, you know, other creators. And one of the hardest parts about independent comics is being able to market your own book. And I mean, Image does a lot of promotional stuff for us, but you know, we do rely on a lot of our own networking. What are some things that you've done beyond this PDF? What are some other things that you've done to market the book to kind of a larger audience?
Well, one thing, you know, certainly things like even like what we're doing here today are important, you know, just getting out there and getting on people's podcasts, getting on, you know, anywhere that you can to just talk about the book is certainly the most important thing I think that you can do. Working social media is clearly important. These are kind of basic or obvious things. I mean, they're, you know, it's not a secret anymore that you need to be on Twitter and you need to be on Facebook and you need to have your website. You need to do all that kind of stuff. Beyond that, I think, you know, going to cons is great. Doing in-store appearances is great. I don't have a big answer to that question. I don't think anybody does, and not just in comics. They're thinking about how to promote all kinds of different things in new ways. I can tell you that movie people are thinking about it. That's for sure. Thinking about you know, how are we going to, because the reality is we're so inundated now with advertisements that just an advertisement beyond sort of brand awareness, it doesn't really work anymore. Because there were just, there's so many of them now. There's so many commercials. There's so many billboards. I mean, I know I live in LA, so it's kind of worse than most places. But when I go home to Oregon, it's still, there's still a lot of advertisements all over the place where they just become part of the background now. So, you know, it's about, I think one thing it's about is giving people a chance to interact, giving people a chance to really become invested in a particular style. I think it's about building a personal brand that stands for quality, that stands for a certain, you know, what I want is for when people see my name on a comic book or a novel or a movie or whatever, they'll know that a certain amount of passion and hard work and quality went into that thing. Now, they may not love it, but it's not going to be schlock. You know, it's going to be something that I actually gave a shit about and tried to really make work and make happen. And that's what I tell people is like, look for my name on things because I'll only do things that I think are cool. I won't do things that I don't think are cool. And that's, I guess that's been true for a long time too. I got that piece of advice from Jerry Seinfeld in some interview where he said, he was talking about the decision to do Seinfeld. And he said, you know, I just thought it would be good. Like I thought it would be cool. And I had had, he had had offers to do other, you know, crappy TV shows or whatever before. And he didn't do them because he didn't want people to start thinking that he was crappy, you know, and because then they wouldn't like him anymore. He only wanted to let things out there that were good. And yeah. I think in a certain way, it's because there's so much stuff out there now, because it's just a constant flood of things. I would rather do, I mean, I want to do as many things as possible, but I think standing for quality and standing for actually trying to do something good has to mean something. Like if that doesn't end up meaning something in this marketplace, then I don't know how you market anything anymore. So that's what I'm going to try to do is do it with product, do appearances, do get out there as much as I possibly can is really all I've been doing. And then, you know, the other thing is that I try to do with the books is target certain high status people who you think might like them.
Right.
So like, you know, one tweet from a Patton Oswalt, can sell a lot of comics for me. You know what I mean?
Right.
See what I'm saying? Like, so what I've done is I've tried to contact as many people as possible that I know who read comic books, who have a little name, Patton Oswalt being an example, who I never actually managed to get him the books, but I tried. And, you know, the Brian Posehn's of the world and a lot of people in the alternative comedy scene, it's a scene I know, it's people I know. A lot of those people read comic books, you know. There's athletes who read comic books, a lot of like NBA players, that kind of stuff. They all read comic books. I mean, literally, if you can go out there, you can't because there's no NBA this year, but go out there. If you live in Memphis, go to a Memphis Grizzlies game and go out behind the stadium to where the players come out of the locker room after the game. And when one of those players comes out, have your book there, have it ready and hand them a copy and say, this is really cool. Here's my card. If you like it, you can get in contact with me. I'll get you more. And then maybe they'll read it and maybe they'll tweet it. And maybe they'll like, those things sound ridiculous, but that's what I've spent the last year doing is trying to figure out ways to get people to do exactly that. Because those are kind of the things that matter now as much as anything. It's just that kind of awareness. There's no really good way to get that besides just try. Just ask people and ask people and ask people and ask people and try to ask people who might actually be interested. You know, try to like have a strategy and target people and don't be stalkery or weird. Like have some social grace. These sorts of things are not really secrets. But the secret is that you actually have to do those things in order to become successful. you really do have to do that. So
you got to find a way to set yourself apart because, like you said, there's just so much content out there, you know, advertising and stories and everything. You somehow have to be different and get noticed somehow. So yeah, those things are all totally viable. I mean, I don't think they sound that crazy.
when MTV started, they didn't have any videos to play. There weren't any videos. Like nobody was making music videos. So they put Weird Al on TV 4 hours a day doing shtick because they didn't have anything else to play. He was just like, yeah, I've got videos. I make these videos. And so they just started playing them. Duran Duran got heavy rotation on MTV, like in the 80s, because not because they loved Duran Duran, but because they actually had videos. That will never happen again. There's no content shortage anymore, ever. As soon as a new platform opens up, there's 10,000 people waiting there with their noses pressed against the door to get in on it. So you have to find some other way to stand out. You just have to find some other way to do it.
Yeah, and that's definitely been, you know, just to talk with my fellow co-creators is like how we do that. And, you know, there's talk about, you know, branching out into other medias, like, you know, for instance, with Green Wake, we signed some kind of exclusive content deal with, we didn't sign it, but we agreed to it, with Daily Dead, so that they get, you know, an extra page of art when nobody else does, and they get, they're mostly horror movie traffic, but ours is horror comics. So, you know, there may not be a lot of comic readers on there, but if they love horror, they might check out my book. So they're just like diversifying who, you know, who sees the pages of your comic.
But also targeting, diversifying. But like you just said, they may not be comics fans, but they're horror fans, and that is what the internet does allow you to do is target very specific audiences. And that can be, you know, it can be maddening because on the internet it's hard to get anybody but those specific audiences to look at your stuff. But you can go in there and say, hey, I already know you guys like this because your website is called that. So here, check out this thing that's kind of like that. Like that's a good thing to take advantage of.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one of the things I also want to talk to, there's two parts to the question. The first one is generally, what is your writing process like when you sit down to start writing either a story idea or a script? What is the origin and how does it all come about?
Well, you know, I would start with the caveat that it's different for each one. I mean, it all starts somewhere different. You know, sometimes it's an image that I particularly want to see. Sometimes it's a character that I feel strongly about. Sometimes it's a concept. What I've started trying to do. So that's how I always. There's some thing that I want to be in there because I think that's a lot what the development process is, what sort of not actually physically writing is about, but planning is about, is the problem that we have is that there's an infinite amount of possibilities in any given story. It could be about anything. Anything could happen in it. The characters could be anything. And so what you have to do is you have to nail down some fixed points. Then you can start building your construct on top of those points. And you need more than one point because even if it's like, okay, I have a character. This character is going to absolutely be in this story. If the character changes, then it's a different story because the story is about this character. Then you can still build any kind of story around that character. So you need at least one more fixed point. You say, okay, I have this character and then he's going to do this. He's going to do this one thing. Absolutely, that's going to be in the story. It's a story about this character doing this one thing. Once you have at least those two fixed points, and I usually like three or four, but once you have at least those two, then you can start building a structure. You can say, okay, what? Here's the scene I have. What comes around that scene? What else is it? What else is it? What else is it? And that's what I spend, you know, a lot of time doing, weeks or months doing that, writing things out on note cards, going, okay, here's what I know it's about. What else am I going to do? What else could I have? And I'll just write, you know, I'll get an idea for a random scene and I'll put it up there. And I'll get an idea for an interesting character. I'll see someone on the bus and I'll be like, oh, that'd make an interesting character. And I'll put that up there. I'll get an idea for, you know, and then eventually you see a structure start to emerge. Like it's out of that chaos. Eventually you go, oh, well, this will fit here and this will fit here and this will fit here. But I don't usually I'll have a lot of little aha moments, but I don't usually have one big moment of like, oh, here it is, you know, the idea just emerging. Like it's about a lot of little decisions and they're all provisional. They're all like, okay, I can do arrangement A, B, C, D, E. Oh, but D's not really working. So I'm going to take all those elements apart and try a different way. And I just keep doing that until I settle into something that doesn't sort of collapse under its own weight after a few days. You know, eventually I get some sort of semblance of a story where I can look at it and look at it and look at it, and it still seems like it's going to work to me. You know, it doesn't, I don't go, well, there's going to be these huge problems because of X, Y, and Z. And it's that process that you really get better at over time. Like when I was first starting out, I just had no idea what was going to work and what wasn't. And now, and so I would spend days and days and days writing these long scripts or these long things that now I would abandon in 5 minutes because I can look at it and just go, it's not going to work because of X, Y, and Z. So a lot of getting better, I think, is about – there's the element of developing your technical writing, you know, the ability to describe things better, et cetera, et cetera. But there's also that development of planning where you've just seen a lot of these problems before, and so they become obvious to you more and more early on. So what I do is I get the whole story planned out, and I'm a guy who needs to know what the end of the story is before I start. Some people – before I actually start writing it. Some people start with a situation and just write, and a lot of really successful people do that. The Coen brothers do that. The Farrelly brothers do the same thing. I know more about movies. I don't really know how comic people do it. But I have to know the ending before I start. And so once I get the whole outline, the whole structure in place, which I – like I say, if it takes – you know, if it takes a month to write an issue of a comic, 2 to 3 of those weeks will be – and it doesn't really take that long. But if it takes a month, 2 to 3 of those weeks are spent planning, and then it's right. written in the last week. So I want to – that's definitely how my process works, a lot of planning. And then what I do is – while I'm doing that plot stuff, I'm also really trying to develop the characters and add depth. And then when I've planned so much that I'm starting to get sick of it, then I sit down and I actually start writing. And once I try to write, sometimes I'll write disconnected scenes, but I generally try to write beginning to end, start at the first page, go to the last page and do it. When I'm doing comics, I do an additional step where I go and I actually panel out the pages. So I draw out all the – I get to a page outline and then I actually put all the panels onto a page. I can't draw at all, but I just do stick figures. And so I lay them out and I see how it's going to work, and I try to make sure that I can actually envision how each page is going to look, because I fear as an artist there's got to be nothing more frustrating than getting a page – where you're just like, this doesn't – this guy clearly didn't ever think about how this was going to look. He was just like, well, I need seven panels on this page to do my action, so that's what we're going to do. Like,
right.
never thinking about what the artist's problem was going to be. Like, he's got these detailed actions that require all the – and he's got, you know, 9 panels on a page. Like, that's what my first few scripts were before I started laying out every page, was I'd have 12-panel pages where they all have this detailed action on them, and it's like – A, you can't have 12 panel pages, and B, you have to let the action spread out. Like, you can't – you're nobody is going to want to read your comic. So I started doing that, and so I'll get to a page outline. I'll lay out each page, and then once I've got to that point, going through and writing a script is joyful. You know, it's like a great feeling because I've already done the hard work. Like that, all the frustration and all that is done by the planning stage. If I'm having frustration while I'm writing it, that means that I didn't plan enough. It means I didn't spend enough time planning. By the time I get to the writing stage, I'm usually in it. And then I get to the end of the first draft, and then the horror and the pain begins again. Because then you have to wait a week. I'll wait a little while once I get something done, and then I'll go back through it and I'll go, geez, what was I thinking? Like, what, these pages don't work at all. Like, some of these won't work in the slightest. Only occasionally do I write a first draft and go back and read it and go, you know, this doesn't need that much work. That's happened like a couple times in 7 years.
It feels good when it happens, though.
Awesome when it happens. But I think, sometimes I'll think it happens, and then I'll whenever it happens, I'll always sit there for a little while longer with it, because oftentimes I'll get that feeling of like, oh, this doesn't need hardly any work. And then I'll sit there and I'll go, oh, no, there's actually this and that and the other. It doesn't usually need a lot of structural work. Like, I'm pretty good with structure, and the planning really helps with that. So I'm not usually like making big changes to scenes and stuff like that. Where I'm deficient and usually have to rewrite is character. My characters usually start out too shallow and too one-dimensional, and I have to go back and try to add more and add more and add more, but in the same amount of space. You know, I have to go back and just try to make things more nuanced and make things more layered. And so I'll do, you know, and the rewriting is where the different mediums for me really separate. When I'm doing a comic book, I don't do that many drafts usually, because the artist is going to do a draft anyway. You know, like it's not a finished product. A script is not, and so if the artist has problems with it or whatever, they'll tell me. They'll let me know. And so I'm usually doing 2 to 3 to 4 drafts of those and then sending them out, and they're not big drafts. They're polishes, they're read-throughs. With a screenplay, you just do endless drafts because that's just what a screenplay is. Like every time somebody else comes onto a project, they've got their own ideas and their own notes that have to be incorporated. Like the whole idea of screenplays is you just do drafts and do drafts and do drafts. And you're usually doing drafts right when they're shooting the actual movie. Sometimes you're rewriting scenes. It's like, you know, that will happen. Like you will go, I mean, I don't have produced credits yet. So I haven't had a chance to experience this, but apparently people will be called to set and asked, like, we have to shoot this dialogue in an hour and it sucks. Rewrite it.
Oh.
You know, like that's happened. Like there's 150 people standing around waiting for you to rewrite this scene.
Oh my God. That's pressure.
You know, can you imagine the pressure of that? And then when I write prose, prose is actually in some ways it's the easiest for me to write. If it paid better, if they were still selling books to people, I might just try to be a novelist, but it just doesn't pay. I mean, it pays less than comic books. You know what I mean? So I do both those cause I love them, but it's really hard. But prose, I think just cause I grew up reading books nonstop, like I'll do, drafts of prose, but it often comes out feeling pretty good the first time. And so, you know, I'll just keep working. Like you end up, whatever you're doing, I always have to push past several points of going, this is crap. Nobody's ever going to like this. It's horrible. You suck. You're never going to be able to do this. And then I go for a long walk and then I come back and I try it again.
Right.
Like there's always in everything I've ever done, there's been that point where I'm like, oh my God, I suck. And then, you know, you push past it. And eventually you realize you don't suck. You just can see problems that other people are never going to even notice.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely something like sometimes you're your own best critic, but, you know, sometimes it also helps to have other people read it. But, you know, I actually came back and did edits on my novel that I'd written 5 years ago. That was a very strange experience because, you know, I've grown as a writer, and to go back to a story that I wrote so long ago was – it was kind of daunting, and I was actually still happy with how well it stood up, but going back and making changes was hard because, like, you know, if you haven't talked in a character's voice for 5 years, it's very difficult to get back into it.
Definitely.
So
I'm starting the process of, I did a novel, was the first thing I ever did, and I'm just starting the process of trying to go back and rework it now.
How's it going?
It's actually going well. I'm finding somewhat of the same thing. I'm finding my technical writing skills were embarrassingly bad. Like I just, there's a lot of like paragraphs where I'm just like, man, I would never write this way now.
Yeah.
But you know, 6-7 years later, but the story's great. I'm really, I'm excited about it. It's actually, I think it would probably be right up your alley. It's like a futurist novel. It's like a future sci-fi artificial intelligence driven type novel.
Nice. You'll have to keep me informed how the revisions are going on that. We're just coming up to the end here. So is there any more plans for more Samurai's Blood, or what else is on the horizon for you coming up in 2012?
Well, definitely as you well know, it's all about money and opportunity. So I have 50 more issues worth of Samurai's Blood stories planned out.
Wow.
You know, it's an epic deal. What I would like to do is a model like what Lock and Key has done, where it's a series of miniseries. Instead of, I think, just because I work on so many different things, I think an ongoing monthly series, the demands of that would be a lot. You know, I like to be able to take breaks from Samurai's Blood and write other things. But I've been told that there's a good chance that I'll get a chance to do more Samurai's Blood. And I Nam has cautiously said that he is interested in doing more. And so I'm very hopeful that it'll happen. And I've got the second miniseries, basically, like, the first one is classical Kurosawa story. And the second one is going to be like The Godfather, but with samurai.
Nice.
It's going to be rad. And then I've got another series called The Fires of Avalon that's coming out. And I'm not sure exactly when that'll be out. It'll be next year sometime. We're looking at alternative ways to release it, not that it won't be through Image, but alternative sort of schedules that I don't want to get too much into. But basically, as you know, the pre-orders are such an important part of the game for indie creators. Like, there's just no other way to get your book in stores. If people don't pre-order it, they simply don't order it. And so what we're looking to try to do is maybe find a way to give people a longer period to pre-order it. You know, sort of work it out a little better so that we can demonstrate demand with the first issue, and then hopefully, you know, and sort of roll it over. Because I've seen the first issue; it's actually done, and I've seen it, and it's awesome. Like, the art came out amazingly. It's painted. The story, all the colors are done with paint. It's going to be super, super cool. And the first issue is 40 pages. It's like a big. It's basically almost a double issue. So I want people to order, and I'm behind it so much, and it's going to be a big ask for stores to put that on their shelves if we can't get pre-orders. But with a month to try to promote and get pre-orders, it's really hard to do. You know, it's not that easy to do. So we're trying to work out a way that we can maybe have a longer sort of grace period, that it can come out sometime in the early middle part of next year. You know, the original plan was to do it at the end of this year. It's a little bit in flux, but people, keep an eye on that series, because The Fires of Avalon is going to be super cool. It's another it's like a Arthurian romance type series, but it's another historical series which is a big passion for me, and I just couldn't be happier with how the first issue turned out. I would also say for people, anyone to follow me on Twitter at OG Wiseman. And then also sorry, I've got a few here because I love to I really want to support other people's books, like my friend's books and all that stuff.
Yeah, no worries, man.
People should look for the Red Spike trade. My friend Jeff Kahn did a series called Red Spike that's like a super soldier story that's awesome. And people should look out for the trade of that. You can pre-order that now. Also, the Marksman is David Baxter's series, another good friend of mine. And his fourth issue is in stores right now, 4th out of 5. And then finally, I would say, if people enjoyed Samurai's Blood, they can go to our website, samuraisblood.com. It'll redirect you to the Benroy Pictures site, and you can read, one of the tabs under the Samurai's Blood section is Samurai Prose Stories. And, I write like short stories and stuff from the world of Samurai's Blood. And, you know, it allows me to get a little more in depth and sort of, you know, it's just a different take on the world, but it allows me to flesh out certain characters and backstory and all that kind of stuff in ways that you just can't really fit into a comic. So if people are interested in the world and the story and stuff, they can go to the website and check that out too.
Awesome. Well, it sounds like you've got quite a lot keeping you busy.
Definitely, man. And I didn't get to say this at the beginning, but man, Greenwake is awesome. And Intrepids is actually – I know Greenwake, I think, is getting more critical love, but I am so jealous of the tone of Intrepids. Like, I don't know how you do that. Like, make it exciting and make it fun and make it sort of light at the same time. Like, it's that's a tone I've tried to do before, and it's really hard. So good on you.
Thanks, man. I just eat a lot of Fruit Loops.
That's the secret. Huh? I've been a Captain Crunch man. I gotta convert.
Oh, I appreciate that, man. I really appreciate reading our stuff. Yeah, I mean, Intrepids has been it's done now, but it was definitely a lot of fun and different in tone. It was basically an experiment for me, so I'm glad to hear it panned out.
I think you nailed it, and I turned my brother onto it, and he's digging it too.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate that. Well, I guess we'll have to wrap up there. We're coming to the end of the show. Owen, awesome. You gave some really great insight, and I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Sure. I would do it anytime, man. If you ever need a guest, I love to gab.
All right. Well, we'll definitely keep you in mind. So as Owen said, he's got Samurai's Blood, which will be wrapping up here November 30th. Please do go order that. Go check it out. It's a really fun series. I got a chance to read all five of them this morning, and I enjoyed all of it. And the trade comes out sometime in February, so you can start pre-ordering that on November 30th as well. That is this it for this show. We will be talking to you guys very soon. We always, like I said, have more guests coming your way. And, of course, the regular chat with me, Ryan, and Jeremy will be resuming very shortly. We do apologize for the delay. It's just been a crazy few months. So stay tuned, and lots more coming your way.